George Floyd, Angelo Quinto, Elijah McClain. All three men were killed by lethal force inflicted by the police, and all three deaths were initially blamed on something called excited delirium. For years, law enforcement officers and other first responders were taught that people suffering from this so-called medical condition were uncontrollably strong, irrational, and required the most severe measures to be subdued. The diagnosis became a standard defense to counter charges of police brutality. Now, the American College of Emergency Physicians, the group that wrote and endorsed a controversial 2009 white paper that led to the widespread legitimization of the pseudo-condition, has admitted it was wrong to do so. In the same week, California became the first state to ban excited delirium as a cause of death on autopsy reports and prohibit law enforcement officers from using the term to describe behavior. As an emergency physician who cares for distressed, sometimes unnerved, patients daily, I am relieved and optimistic. But it will require more than ASEP's withdrawal and state bans to undo the damage that excited delirium has done.
That was Utsa G. Khatri, an assistant professor of emergency medicine and population health and policy at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. She was reading from her recent first opinion essay on the end of excited delirium. After a quick break, I'll discuss excited delirium with her and Brooks Walsh, an emergency physician in Connecticut who authored the resolution that led to the American College of Emergency Physicians change.
Right now, millions of Americans are making important decisions about their healthcare coverage for next year. UnitedHealthcare offers a couple tips to help you during this open enrollment period. First, don't overlook specialty benefits like dental, vision, hearing, or wellness programs. Many health plans now offer incentives for exercising or for not smoking, and many Medicare Advantage plans offer gym memberships at no extra cost. Second, check your prescription benefits. Filling prescriptions at a participating network pharmacy or with home delivery may help you manage costs and get the most from your prescription coverage. For more tips, visit uhcopenenrollment.com.
Welcome to the First Opinion Podcast. I'm Tori Bosch, editor of First Opinion. First Opinion is Stat's platform for interesting, illuminating, and provocative articles about the life sciences writ large, written by biotech insiders, healthcare workers, researchers, and others. Welcome, Utsa and Brooks.
Thank you for having us.
Glad to be here.
So I want to start by asking, Utsa, what exactly is excited delirium supposed to refer to, and how long has the concept been around?
So that's an interesting first question to ask, because part of the history of the term is that there is no widely accepted definition. I think, generally speaking, it's supposed to refer to a condition where the individual exhibits agitation, confusion, is not thinking clearly, and the description has existed for decades within both medical and non-medical worlds. But in recent years, in the last couple of decades, it's raised a lot of controversy.
And Brooks, can you tell us a little bit about that controversy around the supposed diagnosis of excited delirium?
That's a broad question.
I'm sure.
It's funny because it's been controversial from the start. Even the back in 2009, when our medical organization, the American College of Emergency Physicians, first approached a resolution to form a panel to study excited delirium, and we can come back to that later. They noted at the time there was a lot of controversy, and they perhaps were leaping ahead of the evidence, and there were concerns documented that they would be setting a standard for something that was incompletely characterized and controversial at the time. I think the controversy comes from a couple places. The label of excited delirium appears to be applied disproportionately to African American and other minority populations, like, you know, Angelo Quinto. On the face of it, it's not clear why. It's also controversial because it uses some very non-medical language, such as superhuman strength or impervious to pain, which I know some of my non-medical friends find implausible that this ever made it into a medical document. The controversies go even deeper. I'm happy to approach them specifically. I think what really brought this into the public eye more overtly is the death of George Floyd in 2020 and the subsequent re-examination of the deaths of Elijah McClain, and even of Manuel Ellis, who's the trial of the police officers involved in his death is currently ongoing, and excited delirium is still invoked as a defense.
And so, you know, I just want to make sure we're all on the same page here. Basically, excited delirium is something that paramedics, that law enforcement officers, and even physicians might invoke to explain why they had to use restraints, chemical or physical, that could be dangerous, that sort of thing. Is that correct?
We don't need excited delirium. I think on a day-to-day basis, we often acknowledge, we see almost on a daily basis patients who are having a bad day, who are delirious, out of control, and we're not sure why. All we know is that we can't begin to assess them until we manage some controlled situation and ensure the safety of the patient and our staff. And so those patients will receive sedation and restraint. But the process doesn't end there. That restraint and sedation is only a tool used to enable us to further evaluate the patient, ensure their safety. We don't need excited delirium. Our job is bigger than that. I think the concern we have is that excited delirium is invoked as a cause of death, and I'm using the words of the ACIP paper in 2009, a cause of death in and of itself, independent of restraint or any other interventions. And I think that's where we mostly have the issue with that.
Yeah, and it seems then, too, that there's sort of a distinction between what it means in some ways for physicians who are in a hospital versus what it means for first responders. Is that right? Like, who would have been diagnosing excited delirium? I suppose I'm just trying to get to what it means kind of in the field versus in the hospital, and understanding, of course, that it's supposed to be sort of independent, but it also seems to be used as sort of a reason why police may have responded more excessively than they might have with a regular person, if that makes sense.
You know, first I'll say that in recent years, you know, this term has existed for decades. This report that we're referencing from ASAP is 14 years old. But in recent years, at any hospital I've worked at, none of my, you know, colleagues in the emergency department would be satisfied describing a patient's condition as excited delirium. You know, we recognize that some patients are confused. They're not thinking clearly. They might be, you know, have risk for becoming violent either towards themselves or towards other staff. And these are all things we are very acutely aware of. And it is our job not just to keep them and everyone else safe, but also to, most importantly, find out what is causing them to act in this way. And so I think the concept, while we don't use the term, the concept is a part of emergency medicine practice, really, wherever you're practicing in the country. I think the term and its use outside of the medical space becomes very problematic when you are using it to describe the result of actions taken rather than to describe a condition that someone is experiencing that should be urging you or, you know, really pushing you to figure out, first of all, how do I keep this person safe? And secondly, how do I find out what this person needs medically, psychiatrically. How do I begin to get this person in a safe place to make sure whatever is causing their condition is determined and intervened upon? That's when it becomes controversial, is when we're using the term to describe someone who died as a result of actions taken, often, as you alluded to, forceful restraints.
Right. So in the examples that you mentioned at the beginning and that Brooks has mentioned, these were people who law enforcement restrained in some way. And then the dispute legally, as I understand it, became whether they died as a result of a restraint or whether they died as a result of excited delirium. So is the idea that excited delirium can be some sort of fatal condition in and of itself, independent of whatever someone from law enforcement might have done? I just want to make sure we're all sort of on the same page definitionally.
I think Brooks and I and our colleagues at large would agree that that is not the case. I think the problem lies in the fact that it has been used to blame deaths in custody on a pseudo condition rather than on the force that killed the patient. I think the names that we described at the beginning of the segment, excited delirium, would never be used to describe what happened to these individuals if they hadn't died.
There was a paper by some medical examiners, Stromer, I think is the first name, where they looked over the literature, case reports, etc. And their conclusion was that in the absence of restraint, there is no death from excited delirium based on published literature. And looking over a few databases that media organizations have compiled, they come to much the same conclusion. And in fact, when you go back and look at the original description of excited delirium as we now understand it, the paper in 1985 by Charles Whetley, the infamous Miami medical examiner, all of those patients were at least handcuffed, and half of them were hogtied, hobble restrained, face down, which is notorious for causing restraint-related death.
So now I want to talk a bit about the 2009 paper. You know, Brooks, as you mentioned, the white paper came out, and even the idea to discuss it was controversial at the time because there was so much debate about whether excited delirium existed. Can you talk about why ASAP decided it was worth taking a stand on?
I'm going to say there are a lot of people, even I've talked with some of the people who are involved, who are authors on that paper, and there were people who are genuinely concerned about deaths in custody, and people with sincere intentions who believe that people who needed medical treatment were instead being treated with force, and that we need to emphasize the need for immediate medical treatment to save lives. And I take those folks at their word. Some of them have rethought their support for that document. Some of them have not. And see, the problem only is the application or misuse of the document. But I think that speaks to what most emergency physicians think, even on that panel, that we're here to save lives and do the best for as many people as we can. I think there have been a lot of questions raised about what the impetus was originally. I think reporting by a Denver reporter, Chris Vanderveen, and the report by Physicians for Human Rights have emphasized that a lot of this was started with seed money from Axon, the corporation that makes tasers, and that the ASAP task force authors came from a meeting that was sponsored essentially by the corporation.
Utsa, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the larger relationship between emergency physicians, law enforcement, paramedics, and, you know, it seems that you all have very different roles, but of course they all sort of interplay, and that kind of dynamic really came to the fore in this debate and discussion over excited delirium. What is generally the relationship like between those three separate groups?
That's a great question. And I think you'll get dozens of different answers depending on the practice setting of the clinicians and law enforcement officers. As Brooke said, everyone in emergency medicine accepts that their mandate, our moral mandate, our clinical mandate is to keep people alive, to save lives, to make sure that we've thought of any deadly condition that could be related to the symptoms they're presenting with and that we've worked them up thoroughly. I think our social mission within the healthcare system and within society at large is the safety net. We are the only place in the hospital that has a legal mandate to take care of every single patient that walks through our doors. And that has really transformed the culture of our practice, and that we take a lot of pride in being the one space where our doors are always open to anyone at any time. And so what that means is that many people experiencing emergencies, whether they're a result of medical conditions, social circumstances, or a combination of the two, are going to find themselves in our space, both because of our expertise at treating the most sick and acutely ill of people in society, and also the fact that we're the only place that many people can go. And so as a result, a lot of injuries or illnesses that may require emergency medicine care are also going to sometimes be of interest or concern to law enforcement agencies, whether it's because there was thought of a crime or implication that there was some, you know, unlawful activity that took place around the incident, whether people are hurt or injured in the process of being apprehended or arrested, whether there are people who brought themselves into the hospital who may have been a witness to something that law enforcement officers want to get more information on and find the hospital as a place where they can get that information. There are dozens and dozens of circumstances where this overlap exists between emergency departments, emergency care, and law enforcement activities. And, you know, this debate and this discussion around excited delirium, I think is just one of the many, many circumstances.
You know, Utsa, one of the things that you write about in your fantastic first opinion essay for STAT is that while excited delirium as a term may finally be ending, you know, we've seen ASAP withdraw the white paper that kind of popularized the term or at least legitimized it. And we've seen California, and you say perhaps other states will follow in banning its use in many ways. The idea of excited delirium itself is probably not going to go away. You know, it reminds me of, you know, stories about people on PCP having superhuman strength, which often feels very coded in many ways. You know, what do you think it's going to take to get first responders and emergency physicians and others to sort of move on from the broader idea that there's some element of the population that, you know, just sort of needs restraints that can be violent and then can be used kind of as a shield for law enforcement?
I think, first of all, what we are going to need as a society is to prevent from people experiencing these situations where they are so confused and agitated and, you know, not thinking straight in public spaces because of the lack of services available to them, you know, across the country, whether we're talking about housing or mental health care that's adequate or substance use disorder treatment. You know, a lot of times when this condition is invoked, it's not always, but often in the setting of people who have something else underlying, whether it's addiction or mental health conditions. And so one of the things that we really need to think about both within our healthcare systems and in our cities and states at large is how do we invest in programs when people, first of all, make sure people have access to care where they're not experiencing such an severe exacerbation of something that has gone unaddressed and untreated for so long. How do we make sure that when people are experiencing this, that they are responded to by a trained medical team and not always, you know, the police without medical training who are responding in a way that they know how to respond. You know, the mission of police officers in society is to maintain public safety. And when we had taught for decades that people who may have this condition cannot be subdued, they do, their usual tools that they have at their disposal are not going to work in this condition, that they have superhuman strength, that they do not respond to police presence. You know, when we create this narrative that is completely like fear invoking, that just set up a situation where I think people felt like the most severe of physical measures was the only option. And so, you know, while I think the recent development with ASAP officially and finally rejecting the paper and the term and joining many other medical organizations in doing the same is a step, all of the holes within our healthcare system and society where everyone experiencing this type of situation is responded to with force and fear and criminalization, none of that has really changed overnight. And so I think we have a long ways to think about how we respond to that.
I'm just going to add on top of that, especially with regard to, you know, the case using Elijah McClain as an example. I don't think I mentioned myself and a few other emergency docs and emergency psychiatrists wrote a paper about the 2009 white paper, and we discussed the role of the stereotypes in constructing excited delirium. What's concerning about the case of Elijah McClain is not just that there would be an attempt to excuse his death on a fictitious syndrome. It's that the encounter was prompted by the framing of excited delirium. The concern about using these old American stereotypes, then codifying them in a medical syndrome, is that psychologically, this may prompt people to see a Black subject such as Elijah as much more dangerous, larger, stronger than he really is, to attribute more bizarreness and inability to respond to the police than he really is manifesting at the time. I think people were pointing out that he actually was complying with a good amount of the commands, but he was continuously characterized as resisting. And so even the report that went over, the Colorado report that went over the death of McClain, noted that these stereotypes had a role in starting the encounter and in exacerbating the relation. So is excited delirium going to stick around with us? As a cause of death, no. But these ways of seeing Black and minority men, it's been going on for centuries. And these stereotypes are still out there, if not as explicit understandings, but as implicit understandings, as unconscious reactions. And I think those are going to be with us for a while.
That was very well said, and I totally agree. And I think, you know, in reflecting on some of the recent developments around this term, I think one of the things I think a lot about is this idea that medicine or healthcare, by some miracle, is impervious to racism. You know, like this idea that we live in a society that in every institution has racist foundations, racist manifestations of different policies, and that somehow we would like to think of ourselves as not being affected by the same racist structural forces that exist and have existed for centuries in our country and in our society. And I think that this discussion, you know, that people have recognized were unexcited delirium were based on racist tropes, the superhuman strength, the pain tolerance, the not fearing police response. These were all very racist ideas that somehow became codified into a pseudo syndrome. And I think as emergency physicians, as physicians, as people who work in healthcare largely, recognizing that we are not any more immune to racism that exists in society, in our clinical thinking, in our conversations. We would like to think that, you know, everyone would like to think that they are practicing sound clinical science, evidence-based medicine. But there are plenty of instances, and this was just one example, where whatever stereotypes, whatever discrimination exists outside of the healthcare system was also brought into it. And then, you know, taken back out with even much more power and force than anyone intended.
I think you mentioned in your essay, you guys, you did work at, you've been part of a work on research on how often we restrain Black versus white patients. That same work was done with Ambrose Wong and Edward Coupe Jr. and some other folks at Yale that to what I've written with, not with that project, but since that, I think that involved our data from our emergency department as well, it does cause some reflection. Where does this come from? Is it me? Is it the system? Where does it start? It's tough to wrestle with, but bracing to see the evidence.
Yeah, you know, Utso, one really important point from your essay that I don't think we've touched on yet is that in some ways this concept, whether we call it excited delirium or not, can be an obstacle to medical care that people actually need, right? You mentioned that there are some conditions that people may have, and if they're written off by either first responders or emergency physicians as, you know, having some sort of strange superhuman strength moment, you might not notice that they actually are having a very serious medical emergency that's not even related to substance abuse. Could you perhaps discuss that a little bit?
Yeah, I think what we're trained to do really well in emergency medicine is with very little information, make really quick and complex decisions on making sure we go down a list of, you know, could these conditions be caused by X number of diagnoses, which if undiagnosed or unintervened on could be deadly or cause permanent disability? And have I assured myself and my team and my patient and their families that I've thought about them? And this is true regardless of what symptom you come in with. When we examine the patient, whatever we order, we very quickly have to make sure we've thought about everything life-threatening. And when people come in confused and agitated and sometimes violent, yes, sometimes they could be related to mental health conditions or substance use, but there are also many other conditions, some of which, you know, would be life-threatening if you did not diagnose quickly, that they could be caused by. And so this idea that kind of anchoring on a term or a syndrome would cause anchoring or premature closure of the investigation that the patient actually needs and deserves.
I was smiling because as you were talking about that, I thought about a phrase that would be sure to get Dr. Khatri's pulse going up a couple points is, don't worry about them, doc, they're just a drunk. One of the most dangerous phrases we can hear on a shift.
Certainly.
And who would you hear that phrase from? Would it be from a paramedic, from law enforcement, from another physician?
Yes.
All of the above.
We all get tired. We all fall back on our biases, on fatigue, limiting our critical thinking at the moment, and learning how to recognize that tendency and how to counter it, that's key in this job. You won't last long without dealing with your biases.
And it also seems, too, that just the nature of what you all see every day is, you know, is exhausting, right? And in some ways, it's a coping mechanism to be able to dehumanize a little bit, even as it feels both sort of protective in a way of you, even as it's not necessarily helpful for a patient, the opposite of helpful, in fact. I mean, can you talk maybe just a tiny bit about how sort of burnout and dehumanization can be related here?
Certainly the evidence, I forget the citation, but there is evidence that implicit biases in healthcare rise as fatigue increases. We fall back on our less critical or less analytic thinking at those times.
Yeah, and I would add that I think increasingly we describe what many of us in emergency medicine and other realms of healthcare feel less as burnout and more as moral injury. You know, it's not that we are over it, or, you know, we're just like tired of seeing these things over and over again. It's that it causes, you know, psychological, spiritual, physical burden and harm to see people suffer many times by no fault or control of their own. Like Brooke said, it's people on their worst day. It's people who have just started to fall off the cliff, and it is our job to catch them day in and day out, and not seeing investments made beyond what we can do to temporize them in the emergency department, I think, causes moral injury.
I'm so glad you mentioned moral injury, because I think one of the most read first opinion pieces of all time is from 2018 by Simon G. Talbot and Wendy Dean, talking about how physicians aren't burning out, they're suffering from moral injury. So anyone who hasn't read that piece, I strongly recommend it. And Utsa, what I really appreciate about the way you phrased that metaphor of catching people falling off the cliff is that catching somebody who's fallen off the cliff is really hard on your own body. So it's just such a perfect way to describe what you all do every day.
We don't want to.
Right. It's way easier to pull someone back off the cliff than catch them when they're already falling, right?
I think Dr. Khatri and I would much rather a system which keeps people away from the cliff altogether. Nice fence, nice phone number to call, you know, a nice ride to somewhere else away from the cliff.
We've talked about some really difficult topics today, even as we've talked about the hope of seeing excited delirium sort of become forcibly retired from some of the nomenclature. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what you're optimistic about when it comes to emergency medicine and supporting people who, as you say, are having the worst days of their lives.
The optimism. You know what? What I'm really optimistic about is 3 years ago, when I read the 2009 ASAP white paper report on excited delirium, and just experienced just a considerable disappointment in my professional organization. I started writing a paper, started talking to people, started reaching out. And at the time, it seemed really difficult to imagine getting any sort of conversation going about this. When myself and Kevin Durgan and Kevin Krause and a bunch of other people sponsored this resolution at ASAP in Philadelphia just this year, I was amazed to look behind me and see a bunch of other people lining up to offer testimony in support of the resolution. Folks I'd never talked to, offering such thoughtful and reasoned support for this resolution. I realized that like this wasn't just, you know, a wacky project some of us were thinking about. This really meant something about where emergency physicians are going in their thinking. And I thought that was really encouraging.
Yeah, that was great. And I wasn't there in person, but there was a lively discussion in all of the professional groups on what you're describing. The fact that this resolution brought together so many people, brought together our specialty in doing the right thing, and that it was passed. And so kudos to you and your colleagues, Brooks, for organizing all of us. I would say that, you know, we are coming out of one of the most trying times in our careers, coming out of the pandemic, where I think for many people who had never really needed to think about needing emergency care or what emergency medicine is, it was kind of brought to everyone's mind through either the news or having to, you know, come to our spaces. And I'm optimistic that both people within healthcare and outside of healthcare have really recognized the role we play for the healthcare system and for society. And I'm optimistic that we, as a specialty, have always, you know, embraced this concept of anyone, anytime. You know, that you hear that a lot in emergency medicine conferences and lectures. And I think it really succinctly describes what we do and what we feel excitement to get, you know, go to work on overnight shifts or on weekends or holidays, this social and moral mandate to be the space for everyone. And I think the work that came out of ACEP this past year, recognizing that with that mission, our responsibility, the power of what we do and who we care for, sometimes it goes beyond, often goes beyond our emergency department spaces. And it is our mission and our mandate to make sure that what we're promoting and what we are advocating for also extends beyond just our emergency departments.
Utsaji Khatri and Brooks Walsh, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experiences today.
Thank you.
Delightful conversation. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the First Opinion podcast. It's produced by Teresa Gaffney. Alyssa Ambrose is the senior producer and Rick Burke is the executive producer. And I hope you'll consider signing up for the First Opinion newsletter. Every Sunday, I send out an email with the previous week's stories, plus some thoughts from me, including a recommendation for a book, movie, TV show, or podcast. You can find a link to sign up for the newsletter in the show notes. And if you have thoughts on First Opinion podcast, please email me at first.opinion@statnews.com. And, you know, while you're at it, if you have a minute, please leave a review or rating on whatever platform you use to get your podcasts. Until next time, I'm Tori Bosch, and please don't keep your opinions to yourself.